The SGGQA podcast is brought to you in part by Me Audio. So here's the deal. If you've ever seen me in a live stream or in an interview or some other kind of video, you've probably seen me wearing some fancy earbuds. For the last couple years, my work buds have been almost exclusively from Me Audio. Excellent drivers, fantastic accessories, and both my wife and I had our ears scanned by the folks at Me Audio for custom molded ear tips. Super comfy. The MX line of Pro in-ear monitors is one of the easiest lineups to understand, starting at $60 and built around actual professional use. Detailed sound and durable construction, but also with some fun options like customizable faceplates. Even if you're not working on stage or in studio, Pro solutions like these are fantastic audio options, and they don't need to break the bank. And the company also supports a lineup of consumer gear with options for true wireless and noise-canceling Bluetooth earbuds, adapters for TVs to stream your audio to nicer headphones, and headsets for kids to help control the volume on fresh, developing ears. I can't stress that last one enough. We have to start kids out with healthier listening habits. It's a great combo, high-quality audio gear built by a team of folks with recording-grade use in mind, but at consumer-friendly prices. But of course, I can do you one better. If you shop the kit at meaudio.com and use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, you can save an additional 10% over their already competitive prices. Once again, meaudio.com, M-E-E-audio.com. Shop some fun kit, promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, 10% off. Keep your ears and your wallet happy at the same time. I want to thank the folks at Me Audio for hooking up the promo code. Now, let's get on with the show. All right. I believe this means we are live. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions, welcome to another episode of Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I did not prep. I can usually make it farther through my spiel in one breath, but here we are. It's another Monday morning, and it's the calm before the Google I.O. storm. This is where I need soundboard effects, and I'm absolutely miserable at adding soundboard fancy effects and stuff. Already seeing some fun people in both chats right now. I'm seeing Rupin and Sold and Tato and Lacunas, and I'm seeing Gormlord and Barry and Lampros and Dafe and Bray Gray and Farhan, Al Sabakli, Ron Guido, J-Man150, JMX Warrior, Kappa Cash, Mr. Barry Johnson, Hawks, Bionic Scoop. I think we're going to be in for a great show. I know I'm missing a few names in there, and I apologize. But we've got a lot to get through, and part of my normal spiel. Welcome everybody to the show. I'm Juan Carlos Bagnell, aka Some Gadget Guy, the SGG of this terribly named podcast. The QA is the really important part, question and answer. We like to make this an interactive conversation about tech news topics and tech politics and gadgets and reviews and all that fun stuff. I normally go and do a whole spiel about, I hope you had a nice weekend. I do hope you have a nice you had a nice weekend. This week's show, I'm going to have to keep a bit more efficient, and everybody in the chat is already laughing because I think last week's show was like a three-hour show. what I got to do? My daughter's school had a really lovely talent show on Thursday. It was great. My daughter didn't perform, but she just really wanted to be there and see her friends on stage. And it was lovely. And then I woke up Saturday morning and I had just a rager of a sore throat. And it kind of got worse yesterday, and now I'm kind of feeling fine today. So I can't really blow my voice out today like I do most weeks. So we're going to try and keep this a little bit more focused, a little more efficient. We're going to chat some of the top tech news. We're going to be looking at some of the rumors for Google I.O. And then I want to leave some time at the end. I've been playing with OnePlus Pad, Xiaomi 13 Ultra. I did a quick revisit on the Pixel 7 Pro and how to turn it into some kind of vlogging monster machine. And so if folks are along for the ride, we've got plenty of time to do some fun Q&A. Dave Burns, absolutely not taking bets on how long the show goes over this week. That's hilarious. Baker Jeremy saying, what's up, everyone? Vince Naveau saying, hey, everyone. J-Man 150, hope everyone is having a nice bank holiday. Everyone else, for everyone else who is having the bank holiday in the UK. So if you have the day off in the UK, I hope you're having a lovely Monday off. It sounds nice. I hope you're doing something fun. I hope you're eating good food. So why don't we, let me get this out of the way. Why don't we jump into a little housekeeping? Because last week was a pretty busy week. We had a lot of stuff going on. TK and I on Best of Our Week had some fun things to chat about and to show off. We were talking OnePlus Pad and Xiaomi 13 Ultras, and I just want to get this queued up here. Okay, so that's where the podcast was. All right, just checking this out right now. I was holding it up. I did a whole sort of separate look back video talking Pixel 7 Pro so that we could look at some video production and how to turn a phone that is really known for its point-and-shoot camera capabilities into something that's a little bit more production-ready, like some accessories and some techniques to keep in mind when you want to maybe do something a bit more advanced, shooting reels, TikToks, YouTube shorts, or just straight-up vlogs from a phone like the Pixel 7 Pro. Then immediately after that, I produced a video showing off some of the new photography features and some of the new camera hardware on the Xiaomi 13 Ultra. This phone is really special. I feel like some of the early reviews on this phone have been kind of silly. When you have a phone for a week, you can't really call it a review. Hey, I was using the phone with the earliest software that no one else will ever get a chance to play with after updates, and oh, it's got some bugs. You know, some of the cameras glitch sometimes, and you're like, that's not how this works. But I really feel the Xiaomi 13 Ultra is something kind of special, and so I produced a video talking about that. And then lastly, just because I was getting some snarky comments from people on the OnePlus Pad, I shot a video on the OnePlus Pad comparing it against a laptop, and if we tried to match the price to performance of like a student grade laptop, something in the $500 territory, or I actually bumped it up to include the keyboard dock, so somewhere in the $600 territory on an Intel powered laptop, I think it's very interesting what you can do with a tablet today, and how people still tend to think of tablets as things that just like, oh, well, if I want to, like, watch a video on it, it's a bigger screen. So that's pretty neat. And instead, you could be looking at these as more full-fledged sort of laptop replacements. The tech boy. But one, average consumers don't shoot vlogs on their phone. I feel in a world where short form video services are kind of taking over, where every photo sharing site has now become a snippet of video site. The idea that average people aren't trying radically to create enormous amounts of content from their phones is one of the worst takes that tech reviewers have ever come up with. Oh, but average people. No. No, tech reviewers maybe aren't doing that, but average people are quite a bit. A substantial number of people are trying to jump in there and, you know, do some of that fun stuff. I'm going to take a sip of coffee here real quick. Steve Pogue, and here I am. So, that was the main three like major videos that I was finally able to finish up and get out on the YouTubes. I also did like a quick editorial on the Patreon, patreon.com/somegadgetguy, where YouTube wants me to run a Samsung fan channel. I woke up Sunday morning and was just kind of poking around some of the tools and some of the analytics and stuff that all of us YouTube creators just have to be a part of. And it was really interesting. When you go to your analytics on a desktop browser, it looks very different than if you try to use the YouTube Creator app. And so I'm going through the YouTube Creator app on my phone, and I'm trying to see, like, well, is there any other information that maybe YouTube can, I mean, like, kind of guide? I mean, the whole point of YouTube is to try and build and maintain an audience and interact with people. And even with a medium-sized channel like mine, like, that can be very difficult in the current flavor of the YouTube algorithm. And so if you go on to the research tab on a browser, it's very minimal. But then I go to the research tab on my phone and it's got all of these suggestions and there are gaps and your viewers also like these other topics. And basically 3/4 of my recommendations are, you should turn your channel into a Samsung channel. Oh, you like talking about tech? Well, then you should talk about Samsung. Oh, did you make a video about tablets? You should talk about Samsung. And it's just really disheartening. So I wrote up an editorial on the Patreon, just kind of, and it's a very sloppy editorial. I mean, it's Sunday morning, so I'm like cribbing this out. I'm kind of working off this sore throat. I'm just getting that information out there. And it's not my best writing, but it was a little frustrating. Like, here's this new tool and you can use YouTube Analytics and they're going to give you information about your audience's behavior. And instead it was just like, well, you should only talk about what's already the most popular. And you're like, yeah, that sounds about right. That sounds like it's on par for YouTube and Google being the advertising company that it is. So, that's housekeeping. 9:09 in the AM. Ba-boom. We're really going to be flying because I want to get to Google I/O and that we're going to save that for the second half for what we would normally call the gadget block. All of the links and show notes, everything that we're going to be talking about this week in links will be available on my webzone, the somegadgetguide.com. No, somegadgetguide.com. I need to stop ironically adding the to all of these website names because now I'm doing it by habit and now I just said the wrong web address for my website, so that's bad. I had this conversation with Lex. Sorry, I'm going to sidetrack my own podcast. She started doing like wacky little kid voices because she's mimicking what she hears in cartoons and stuff, and she's purposely started saying some words wrong because they're malpropisms from one of the shows that she likes. And I had to like sit her down and like, if you practice saying it wrong, you will eventually not be able to say it right. And this like idea like did not compute. And so now I've got to be careful because I'm doing the exact same thing, ironically adding words to the Facebooks and the Twitters is now meaning like, and my website is the Some Gadget Guy. Oh no, my website is not the Some Gadget Guy.com. Dave Burns, 3-hour show. I'm calling it now. No, we're not going to do that. Barry Johnson, man, I would be bored to tears if all I focused on was Samsung phones and tablets. I'd make a lot more money, though. That's for darn sure. YouTube really has no interest in supporting your audience if you try to broaden. And that's what's part of the editorial is talking about. What's frustrating is, like, I've been trying to incorporate more outdoor technology, more, lifestyle and mobility, e-bikes and scooters. Like, we can see smaller channels that are finding success with these niches. And touching on these topics, YouTube craters my channel. It's like, instead of stapling together and trying to bring a smartphone audience into talking more about e-bikes, it's like, well, the algorithm saw that the person who watches your channel really likes phones, and we tried sending it out to 3% of your audience base, and then it didn't immediately explode. So now we're just going to tank this video. And it's so disheartening. It is such a gatekeeper-y, upsetting barrier. Because what YouTube seems to want right now is to everyone niche down. And so if you talk about tech, they want you to pick a specific topic in tech. And then once you pick a specific topic in tech, you're only really supposed to talk about like the most popular idea of that. So you like broad consumer tech, well, niche down to smartphones. Oh, you're talking about smartphones? Well, the most aggressive advertising spending company is Samsung. So you should just talk about Samsung. And there you go. There's a YouTube channel. And financially, that works. You will make more money on... If you set up a YouTube channel today and you work to get your view time and your monetization stats and all that stuff, you get approved for the YouTube Partner Program. I guarantee you, if you did nothing but make videos about Samsung, you will make more money in 3 months, like getting up to speed, getting your channel stats, getting all that work done, than I will make on a channel with 150,000 subscribers. Easy. That's the gig. That's the gimmick. That's the hook. You could totally do that. You could totally do that right now. But I also feel like Barry's saying, it'd probably be real boring. And I'm just not, I get real bored if I have to only talk about not only one thing, smartphones, but if I only have to talk about like one company that makes smartphones is kind of the worst. And that makes me cop a cash. Some Samsung guy has a nice ring to it. That just hurt my soul. On Lampros, thank you. Lampros is saying, if your throat is not well, keep it short, no need to strain it. And we're like I said, we're going to fly through some news, some things that we need to keep an eye on, and there just seem to be, you ever notice, like, we go through these every couple of weeks, there's just like a theme. I didn't wake up this morning, how well planned my podcast is. I kind of put everything together Sunday night, and then most of the show order is completely flip-flopped Monday morning. So I had another thing where I was looking at some more, like, sort of out there, like, software development stuff, and a lot of AI conversation is happening on the news right now. And I woke up this morning and was just like, Facebook's getting hacked. Blue Sky is stumbling, and Twitter Blue just looks like it's a complete bust. This morning completely flipped into social media is melting down all around us. Excuse me. So that's what we're going to talk about. Why don't we jump through some news here real quick, and we can make it through this news block, even with that extended rambling. It's only 9:15 in the a.m., so I have done okay for housekeeping. Housekeeping is usually a 30-minute affair, so I'm feeling pretty good. All right, I wanted to start this off just because there's a certain reputation for, like, software engineers in Silicon Valley. And even today, I feel like there's a very common entrepreneurial, quasi-libertarian thread that goes through a bunch of techies. So you know a company that employs a significant number of software engineers has screwed up major in how they're presenting employee perks versus CEO compensation if there is ire from libertarian-leaning, entrepreneurial-leaning software engineers. So this story coming by way of Ars Technica, my bro crush John Brodkin wrote this up. Googlers angry about CEO's $226 million pay after cuts in perks and 12,000 layoffs. Sundar Pichai compared to Lord Farquaad as employees share memes about CEO pay. Quote from, this was also reported by CNBC, but quote from the article, in the week since Pichai's annual compensation was made public, internal Google platforms have filled with conversations and memes, slamming the CEO for taking a pay bump while slashing costs elsewhere. CNBC reported yesterday. CNBC's report said internal memes shared by employees also criticized Google owner Alphabet's recent authorization of a $70 billion stock repurchase program, the same amount as last year, the year where Google made more money than it had ever made in the company's history. And still somehow, I think, in the last quarter, managed to miss expectations. But I digress. Pichai is the CEO of both Alphabet and Google. Dave Burns. What do you say? They're all libertarians until the bank with all their money fails. And Copycash, I would be angry too. Hold on, let me get this out of the way and let me get out of screen share here. You've messed up. So here's the deal. When a company makes a ton of money and they don't really invest it back into the company, I feel the employees have sort of they have earned some of their frustrations. And to hear that Google is again doing a $70 billion stock buyback while Sundar Pichai gets a compensation bump, after all of the, I take full responsibility. Remember, because Sundar Pichai came out and he's like, I take full responsibility And my taking responsibility means 12,000 people lose their jobs. But me, I know that our direction completely missed the scope of eventually we would return to work in a way that the global pandemic would not be affecting. But it's me, Sundar Pichai. I take responsibility. And you're losing your jobs are a sacrifice that I'm willing to make. Because that's the quote from Lord Farquaad from the Shrek films. So yeah, not a great look. As again, it's really difficult because you've got to compartmentalize. I've been so excited to sort of revisit the Pixel 7 Pro on the heels of the Google I/O and the Pixel 7a, and maybe getting some idea of what the Pixel 8 is going to bring. I'm super stoked about what the Google hardware team is doing, but man, I really haven't had a lot of confidence or a lot of faith in the executive leadership at Google, the people at the top of Alphabet. I don't think they've been utilizing resources well. I think they've been playing corporate games with, I mean, like a stock buyback. A $70 billion stock buyback is a dumb look right now. Because you can't have this both ways. You can't go out to your shareholders and say, like, well, last quarter we made more money than we've ever made in the company's history, but now we've all got to really tighten our belts, and we're going to tighten our belts by spending $70 billion on playing games with stocks. Instead of, we're investing in our talent and looking at a long-term roadmap that's going to bring us the next era or the next phase of profitability, they're playing this game. And that, to me, is tragically hilarious. It's a comedy that you have to laugh to keep from crying. Brian Glaze, I take full responsibility in keeping my job and others being fired. And I have taken responsibility to the tune of $20 million extra dollars for me. Gormlord, anytime you want to make a Beavis and Butthead reference, it's fine by me. Sveticus, the recent Pixel 8 Pro rumors have me really rethinking my Pixel Fold purchase. I have my pair of Surface Duos, and I've got things like my LG dual display cases. I'm not as hot on foldables. I keep playing with these unbelievably good camera phones, and I don't want to step down. I don't want an awkward square folding tablet that's more fragile and then have to give up my amazing camera sensor phones. So I've been sticking with the camera. Sveticus, I am much more interested in Pixel 8 Pro than I am Pixel Foldable. So I hope you all can forgive me. Moving right along. Let's get into this social media malarkey. I like using that word because, like, the picture that they have on this article is Joe Biden, President Joe Biden. So I have to admit, I don't see the buzz on Blue Sky. I don't get it. I really don't. It really just looks like worse Twitter trying to be Mastodon with, like, no users. The only thing that is ever interesting about a new social media platform is that first stage where they're keeping people out. That's it. The buzz is built because people want to be a part of something exclusive. We saw it happen with Clubhouse. Clubhouse was iOS only and was invite only. Excuse me. And people like, oh, I've got to, do you have a Clubhouse invite? I've got to be on Clubhouse. And then it just, you know, I don't know. I know people are still using it, but it's not like the thing. It's not like it replaced all of these other interactions or built itself into this like monument and into this like web activity that is a must join for a broader community of participants. So when I look at Blue Sky, it looks like bad Twitter. It looks like poorly built Twitter. I don't get it. So this article came out May 5th. This was written up at Fortune by Kylie Robison. I have mispronounced their name. I apologize. Blue Sky says no head of state allowed on its Twitter. Oh, no heads of state allowed on its Twitter-like platform for now. Blue Sky, the buzzy social media platform that's emerging as a Twitter competitor, said on Friday that it will not allow heads of state on the service yet, as the fledgling company seeks to control its growth during its beta testing phase. So they're rolling this out. They currently only manage 60,000 users. That's it. 60,000 users are part of this beta. Now, that sounds like a lot. I'm not running a social media service, so I'm handling like 55 concurrent viewers, not 60,000. Fair. They're doing a bigger presentation than I am right now. But I feel like managing celebrity is one of the failings of current Twitter, which we're going to talk about here in just a sec, and is one of the most crucial and critical aspects of launching a new social media service today. Is the viability and confidence in the platform comes from verifying that you are talking to who you think you're talking to. And if you can't handle that, then the service is going to crash and burn, in part because people want to build up a following and have conversations with real folks, and then in the other part, they want to know that they're following famous people. So I just want to read out this last last paragraph here from the article. Blue Sky was originally spun out of Twitter by Jack Dorsey when he was CEO in 2019. And after he chose Blue Sky CEO Jay Graber to run the company, the team struck out on their own and became an independent company in 2021. The 9-person Blue Sky team is currently working on the development of 2 interconnected technologies, a user-facing app that closely resembles the look and feel of Twitter, and an underlying protocol that will serve as an open framework, allowing other developers to construct their own social apps on top of it. So, they're basically trying to rip off Mastodon, because that's really all like what a federated, server-designed social media service really is. You can build your own server and plug that into the rest of the internet to make your own pocket of a social media service. So instead of trying to scramble and get your invite now to interact with 60,000 early adopters on a beta of a closed platform social media service that can't even compete with the features and settings of Twitter, you could just go to Mastodon now. Mastodon has users at scale and has been picking up significantly more users following all of these Twitter shenanigans. Dave Burns, yeah. Oh, hey, that sounds like Mastodon and Bootstrap. Yes. It's hilarious to me because Jack Dorsey's big hot idea is to recreate a closed version that they can eventually try to monetize, a closed version of a Web 2.0 style service. They're trying to crib Twitter and Mastodon, and that's kind of hack. I bet you Blue Sky will find some kind of user base and some kind of an adoption rate, and I bet you it's going to do okay just for having Dorsey's name attached to it. But if you're operating and you're trying to interact with people and you want to reach any number of people, like right now, Mastodon has been a lot of fun. It's like a tiny bit more difficult to set up, and then you're like, oh, but these are the kinds of interactions and conversations I used to have on old social media. This is great. So yeah, Hawks Talks, Mastodon works well. I've been digging it. So I apologize. I've completely butchered your name. What are your thoughts about the Pixel Fold? I will share more thoughts. We do sort of a first half news blog, second half gadget blog. So when we get to the second half and we start talking about Google I/O, we can absolutely dig into some of the conversation about what's going to be going down with Pixels. Because we just want to wrap up some of this news here as we're looking at Twitter. Hold on, let me get this back. So this is a story from Mashable, written up by Matt Bender. More than half of Twitter Blue's earliest subscribers are no longer subscribed. So Elon Musk bought Twitter, way overvalued, for $44 billion, immediately destroyed the credibility of the verification system, and then tried to make it sound like paying $8 a month to get your check mark was going to be in any way valuable. And now they're scrambling to jack the rates on things like API access and business verifications. So hold on, I just want to get into this article here. Twitter Blue struggles since its launch nearly 6 months ago are more severe than previously revealed, new data suggests. Since Musk's version of the subscription service launched last November, Twitter has only been able to convert around 640,000 Twitter users into paying Twitter Blue subscribers as of the end of April, as Mashable reported earlier this week. While those numbers are lackluster, an even more telling detail about Twitter Blue is just how many of its earliest subscribers have canceled their subscriptions. Out of about 150,000 early subscribers to Twitter Blue, just around 68,000 have stuck around and maintained a paid subscription as of April 30. Subscriptions are $8 per month and $11 on mobile. Because you see, the app stores take 30%. So you gotta charge more on mobile. And no, we don't live in an anti-competitive marketplace at all. No, perish the thought.
Hey folks, are you getting bored of the current collection of tech and geek commentary on the internet? Is the discussion of new electronics feeling a bit stale? Do you want to find some fresh voices to add to your subscription queue? Check out the community on rglowingrectangles on Reddit. Now, this subreddit was built to help new voices in the tech community find more audience, and we need your support. Sharing, commenting, and those precious, tasty upvotes. Reddit can radically help a content creator expand their reach. Do you know a producer who deserves more attention? Do you just want to find fun new stuff? Head on over to reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles and share or browse to your heart's content. Once again, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, and let's build something cool together.
So yeah, who could have thunk that this strategy was going to turn out to be not a great strategy, except for all of us. All of us that were saying this destroys the last shreds of confidence in Twitter. Credibility. What little credibility your platform had was in this one system that was desirable. I mean, it took me a lot of effort to get my little Twitter check mark when I was getting impersonated. So someone, thankfully, at Twitter kind of took pity on me. I wasn't huge in terms of numbers, but I was, you know, I was interacting a lot, and I was on a large publication, and I was doing work on TV. Made sense. Now, yeah, not valuable at all. not worth $8 a month. And I just want to point out that a lot of the things that people have said, like, oh, well, I really like this Twitter subscription because I can do things like edit tweets. Every other social media platform allows you to edit posted content for free. Instagram, I can go click in and edit the post that's attached to a photo. Mastodon, I can post something and attach a picture or add, you know, information to that, and then later go back and fill in extra hashtags if I want to interact with people there. It's like you're going to pay for worse versions of all the things you get for free everywhere else. This is the absolute worst. And it kills me because Twitter was my preferred hangout spot. Now I'm spending a lot more time around the rest of the web on the Reddits and the Discords. See, I'm doing it. The Reddits and the Discords and the Mastodons. So, not great. Not great. Sore Hunter. My favorite policy at Twitter is suing advertisers who don't want to advertise on Twitter no longer. I'll be curious to see if Musk really does have the fortitude or the craziness to go after Microsoft for pulling their not only their ad side, but I think they also like severed their API access on some of their infrastructure. Because who's going to pay for Twitter API access? That's not a thing. It's just so sad and it's so funny how cynical all of those moves have have become. Where it's like SMS two-factor authentication. They pulled SMS two-factor authentication because they didn't want to pay for the text messaging. Because the only way you can get it is if you're a Twitter Blue subscriber. But 2FA, SMS 2FA is like the least secure version of that. So you get to pay Twitter to have the least secure version of 2FA. It's not because it was a benefit or it made the service better or it improved the consumer experience or improved consumer security. It was they're too cheap to pay for text messages. They're fighting their lease agreements. It's so sad. I mean, it just really couldn't be more pathetic. Oh. So I think we're all just kind of hanging out, just watching to see, like, will this thing really crash and burn? It's like watching a train wreck in super, super, super irritatingly slow motion with an overgrown man-child trying to narrate the experience as he drives his train off the tracks. Oh, but really? That's interesting. I'll think on that. Nah, not really. So, in other social media news, hacked verified Facebook pages are impersonating Meta are buying ads from Meta. This one kind of broke my brain a little bit. This is over at TechCrunch, written up by Taylor Hatmaker. Hatmaker? I don't know how to pronounce their name, and I'm sorry. I'm real bad at names. Not very good. Okay. Sketchy Facebook pages impersonating businesses are nothing new, but a flurry of recent scams is particularly brazen. A handful of verified Facebook pages were hacked recently and spotted slinging likely malware through ads approved by and purchased through the platform. But the accounts should be easy to catch. In some cases, they were impersonating Facebook itself. Social consultant Matt Navarra first spotted some of the ads, sharing them on Twitter. The compromised accounts include official-sounding pages like Meta Ads and Meta Ads Manager. Those accounts shared suspicious links to tens of thousands of followers through their reach, probably extending well beyond that through paid posts. So that's a real bad look. We've all known that Facebook is super leaky and they're not very secure and they don't do a great job of handling that kind of broad security for people pouring personal information into the platform. So that's bad. But now, not only are pages getting hacked, they're getting hacked and getting changed to resemble official Meta divisions, like your ad manager. And they're buying ads on Facebook to promote services that are likely just installing malware on people's computers. And it took exposing this on Twitter and getting written up on sites like TechCrunch before we saw any kind of action, reaction. That's ridiculous. We invest significant resources into detecting and preventing scams and hacks, a Meta spokesperson told TechCrunch. While many of the improvements we've made are difficult to see because they minimize people from having issues in the first place, scammers are always trying to get around our security measures. Those scamps, those scampy scammers. Oh, they did it again. Oh, gee. Like, I don't know. I'm no computer programmer. I only took a couple semesters of C++. I know a little Pascal. It's just the idea of
someone at Meta going, what did you name your brand page? Meta Ads Manager? Ah, that looks legit. Dave Burns, it truly boggles the mind, this one. Oh, yeah, that's pretty good. Dave Burns, the best cybersecurity tip I have is to completely disconnect from the internet. Yeah, it's like all those jokes at AI conferences. Like, if you want to build the world's best artificial intelligence spam email blocker, you give AI the task. We want to eradicate spam email. And then the AI comes back to you with, kill all humans. Because if you don't have any humans, then you don't have scammers and you don't have people to scam. And we're starting to get there. Facebook is starting to show us, like, no, there's no, like, security or anything like that. It's not great. They can't even keep people from impersonating themselves. And then those accounts are verified, so they look legit. I feel like this one's also really important. You have a process of verification. You have to jump through hoops and say, I am who I say I am. Here is documentation. I forget what the process was on Twitter or what, like, the check mark is on YouTube, but it's like an extra step. You have to say you are who you say you are. On Twitter, as before all of this blue check mark subscription nonsense, if you changed significant information or your Twitter handle, you would lose verification. You would have to, like, re-verify. So there is not a line of code in Facebook to say you have been verified and you have changed all of your information. Are you still who you say you are? Let's see who you say you are. Now you say you're Meta. That's interesting. We're Meta. Oh, I don't think that's right. I'm not saying it's as simple as, like, an if-then-else statement, but maybe there's a table of usernames that are just no-nos. Like, impersonating Facebook employees. And no one thought about that. I love it. It's great. We don't have any kind of proactive approach to cybersecurity or consumer protection at all. It's hilarious. I love it. I love it. I gotta love it to keep from, laugh to keep from crying. And take another drink of coffee here real quick. All right, so that's gonna wrap us up on the news block. Like I said, I wanted to kind of fly through just because that seemed to be the trend this morning. I think we can all acknowledge that sort of an unhealthy fixation on social media is bad for us, but alongside that, on top of that, these companies are not doing great. I really got to say, like, going back to an older style of social media has been way more fun. So Ted is also making the joke here. It's not like I've got any followers over there, but Juan is also using Flickr, too. Flickr's coming back, baby. So way back in the day, I used to have a Smug Mug account. Smug Mug is more of like a professional photo shopping. It's kind of like a stock photography service, but it's also like more of like an art photography service too. And I had like a little gallery up on Smug Mug. I used to take that money and donate it to the JDRF, Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation. But it was kind of like, it was like a yearly subscription fee and you would host your photography there and then people could like shop in your store. And it got to a point where I was not using it as well as I could have. And it wasn't really bringing in money to donate beyond what I was paying to maintain it as a yearly subscription. So I wasn't really taking it seriously. So Smug Mug bought Flickr. And that was the absolute best thing that ever could have happened to Flickr. It was something that we all said very early on in the earliest days of social media. What if on a photo sharing service, like on a Facebook, you could work with Facebook to also set up something like a photography store and you could work with Facebook to do things like sell prints or sell photo books or advertise your services as a photographer. I mean, it's kind of like baked in there. So Flickr getting bought by a service that does that, brilliant. If you're talking about sharing photos, Flickr is the best place to share a photo. Your photo does not get destroyed through really terrible compression. We don't have this split between iPhone apps working better than Android apps, so your iPhone photos somehow always look better than your Android photos. Like, that isn't a problem on Flickr, like it still can be on other social media services. Like how Google had to jump through hoops to get Snapchat to work better on a Pixel. That's not a thing. It's not broken like that. It really is kind of a lovely experience. And you go through your photo feed and it's just a photo feed. It is way less manipulated. It is way less algorithmically sorted for you. I really can't say enough nice things. It really is. Like, Flickr is way better for sharing photos than anywhere else. And where I'm also, like, kind of co-streaming this here over on the Instagrams. Instagram kind of lost me a bit when they changed up the order of your feed. And you started seeing things, like, posts from your friends, like, the day after it happened. You couldn't get back to a feed in real time. And now everyone's trying to focus on short-form video. Guess who isn't trying to focus on short-form video? Flickr! I'm totally back! So it's like Flickr and Mastodon. I'd feel so old, but I'm back into Web 2.0, baby! And Scoop, if anyone should be focusing more on Flickr, Bionic Scoop is one of my absolute fave photography pals. He does amazing things with cameras that I can't even approach. Why aren't you on Flickr, buddy? If anything, Scoop, you should be looking at Smug Mug. You should be looking at, like, you know, monetizing that even more. I know we all shouldn't be turning our hobbies into side hustles all the time, but Scoop, if anyone should be, I'm just saying. So, let me get this out of the way here. Ron Guido, welcome to 2010. When did Flickr come out? Because I think it's even older than that. Hold on. Wiki. Flickr. 2004. I'm back in the year of 2004. I love it. I love it so much. I mean, it's like, again, I'm using all these various services to, like, live stream, and I'm playing with short form videos, and I hate them. I hate doing shorts and reels. I like long form content and hanging out with people. But, man, I really hope that Smug Mug and Flickr can buck all of these trends and just be the absolute best place to share the highest quality versions of your photos. And check it out. And the cool thing is that, like, where they have updated the service, it works so much better now for sharing on other platforms. So you upload your photo to Flickr, and then you share through Flickr, and then if you're on something like a hobbyist Mastodon server, you're not storing the photo on the Mastodon server, but you're getting a great image preview hosted by Flickr. I'm so many things about what Flickr has done have been spot on the right way to do it. And again, if it's about sharing content, if it's just about sort of racking up social media points and getting your likes and stuff like that, then no. I think we would all agree. Flickr is not the place to kind of, like, go viral. But if it's about, I took a great photo and I want to show you that photo, Flickr. All right. J-Man150 says, I need to hydrate. So I'm going to do that here real quick. I actually drink some water, not just some coffee. And then we got to plug the subreddit because we made it through the news block and I even rambled and we got a little time to spare there. Oh, Coppa Cash, while we're at it, can we have Google Plus back too? Oh, I miss Google Plus. I mean, that was, yeah. We want to talk about, like, Google messing up some of these initiatives and stuff. It makes me really sad. Google, again, it's like if your social media service takes just that one extra step for you to create what you want out of it, it's so much more difficult to try and convince people to jump on board. But those are the social media services that people like me, I would imagine people like us, adored. You're just so good. I had all my circles. Anyway, we don't need to completely go down all of that memory lane. JMan150 and Google Hangouts. We're kind of doing that now. I actually think Restream has been a better solution for that than Google Hangouts ever was. When Enabong was doing a weekly podcast on Bored at Work, and I would jump in and join on the Bored at Work podcast, Google Hangouts was always broken. And like Restream and StreamYard and some of these other services have been flipping phenomenal. So, quick plug, every podcast has a subreddit. My podcast is no exception, only my subreddit is designed to help people share content they feel deserves more attention. So tech articles, tech news, tech podcasts, tech videos, self-promotion is allowed. And if you go to reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, you will find this community. We have now officially rounded up to 2,800 members. It's growing slowly, but it's a real grassroots growth. But I also want to point out with around 53, 54 concurrent viewers on this stream right now, people go throw a couple upvotes and you could totally change what was popular. So on the subreddit this week, the number one video was my Pixel 7 Pro video, and the number two video was my OnePlus Pad versus Surface Laptop Go 2 video. And I just want to promise people, this subreddit is not a me subreddit. But literally, all it would take is one person sharing their post on Reddit, and it would probably get more attention and more upvotes than what I currently get on my posts. But the number three, coming by way of Mitchell Millennial, the Pixel 7a has a new 64-megapixel camera, wireless charging, and costs, .. The number four video is Josh Vergara looking at the Moto Edge 2023. And then the number five, rounding out the top five, we've got Munchie with 61,000 subscribers. Google Pixel 7a versus Pixel 7 camera comparison, they're pretty darn close. Because as we all know, Pixel security is not great, and there are already a ton of leaks coming out for the Pixel 7a. There's already been a teardown video, right? Isn't that what? I don't know. It's silly. So, excuse me. Lots of water and coffee burps. I apologize. The biology on this podcast has been aggressive. So, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. Share, contribute, but best of all, if you could go there just every couple of days and click up arrows on content, then you would be helping a number of content creators out. It's what helps us with algorithmically sorted content. If something is popular here on this subreddit, it has the chance to spread to other subreddits. It's really good. Yeah, Ozman, we're absolutely going to talk about that. I saw a video yesterday saying Pixel 7a teardown, and it was a legitimate site. I mean, it was a legitimate YouTube channel. So those phones, Google, really leaky with the whole Pixel experience. It's they do not keep their phones under wraps. I love it. Yeah, Farhan. So that to that same topic. Meanwhile, Sony is keeping their upcoming Xperia 1 Mark V under closed doors. How on earth does Sony do that? We've seen a few things kind of dribble out, but we'll be hearing news soon, hopefully soon, looking at Xperia 1 Mark V. And Copacash. That's probably true. Those are not leaks. That's Google's marketing. Yeah, likely. Because Samsung, we're pretty confident Samsung does something similar where it's probably not a leak. It's probably something that was sort of sideways put out through a back channel to try and gain interest or build buzz for a new product. I don't know. So, I mean, we've got I.O. and then we've got the Xperia announcement. We're like leading into summer with some really hot, hot gear. So it should be pretty exciting over this next week. Oh, man. So I did have... Oh, sorry. Last plug. Reddit.com/r/GoldingRectangles. Go check it out. Go hang out. We have a lot of fun there. And we can kind of contribute to helping content creators that we enjoy their content. So I wanted to highlight one big story here from... this is from the... from pulsenews.co.kr. Who wrote this up? Is there a byline on this? I don't think there's a byline on this. I don't see one. Let me just go and screen share this real quick. We might be seeing some signs of recovery for Samsung. Samsung Electronics improves 4-nanometer process yield to lure back clients. Samsung Electronics Co. began to secure major global clients with an improvement in its 4-nanometer chip technology, which had posed a challenge to its yield at the early stage of mass production. The chipmaker's 4-nanometer process yield is now close to 5-nanometer process levels, the latest process in chip production. The chip's yield refers to a percentage of the total number of chips produced to the maximum chip count on one wafer. So, yeah, Osman, 8 Gen 1, hot or amazing devices hot. Well, in part because of how Samsung took the manufacturing on the premier chips last year. The 8 Gen 1 was not a, well, it was a really powerful chip, but it was not a very power efficient chip. And when you see examples of like a MediaTek, not just outperforming it, but outperforming it and using less power, that was a major concern. And so I think one of the things that we had to take a look at was how Samsung was making, was fabricating the chip design from Qualcomm, and what in TSMC's process, what in their manufacturing improved so significantly that performance per watt. Because the 8 Plus Gen 1 was not made by Samsung. It was made by TSMC, and it runs so much better. It is like night and day difference if you're talking about power management. The performance is pretty close, but the performance per watt is a significant advantage for the TSMC chip. So what we're talking about in this article is Samsung is just now catching up to this new process, 4-nanometers. And they're getting the number of chips on a wafer up to the same level that they were getting, the same percentage, I think, as we were on 5-nanometer. And that's pretty impressive because that's a 20% reduction in chip size. Going from 5 to 4 is actually a really significant change in chip fabrication. But I just wanted to point this out because Samsung is just now getting their yield up, but we don't know if their fabrication maturity is going to bring comparable results. TSMC at 4-nanometers, will TSMC chips be more power efficient at 4-nanometers than Samsung chips? Because that was a major problem, looking at the two companies and what they could achieve. And of course, this is also coming on the heels that TSMC is starting to rank their 3-nanometer. So Apple is likely going to be the first major company to eat up all of the fabrication capacity at 3-nanometers over the next year. But following that, from mature 4-nanometer to, you know, bleeding edge 3-nanometer is a 25% reduction in size. Again, that is a massive order of scale difference. And so Samsung is just getting up to speed on 4-nanometer as TSMC is starting to push into 3. So, Osman, that is absolutely correct. It is a huge jump for Samsung. We should be happy. We need Samsung to be competitive in this field, but this is another example of really kind of, they're a full generation behind. And I loved it because they came out with this this press conference, the statement after their terrible stock earnings, because like we talked about this last week, Samsung profits were down like 95% year over year. But they put out this thing, and I think it's hilarious. We have, I forget exactly what the PR quote was. I should have pulled the link. Man, anyway, I'm paraphrasing here. This is not the exact quote, but it was along the lines of, we are investing in foundry technologies to surpass TSMC manufacturing techniques within the next 5 years.
Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people, producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
I started Tech Potato with a vision. I'd already been covering processes and technology for 10 years as senior editor for Inantech, but only through the written word. With today's media so diverse, I chose to one-up my vision and move to video and explain the nuance of complex topics. Hi, my name's Ian Cutress, and I'm Chief Spud at Tech Potato. The goal at Tech Potato is to have fun, to talk about areas of the technology industry that aren't always covered. Sometimes there are non-obvious aspects to a topic which doesn't always come across in written media, and that's where I strike. The channel is also there to shine a light into the areas that most end users don't even know exist. There's also a tongue-in-cheek joke. Processors are called chips, and just like a bag of chips, I like to get my teeth into these things, hence Tech Potato. The thumbnails are stupid, but the content is real. If you're interested about how things in this technology industry work, or for reports on behind-the-scenes events, plus some classic British humor, then head on over. You'll be welcome with open arms.
So Samsung has already promised to invest over $200 billion into the semiconductor industry in South Korea over the next 10 years. So over the next 5 years, it's going to be roughly a $100 billion investment. $100 billion investment in just their silicon. And they're estimating that with $100 billion, their technologies will beat TSMC in 5 years. And that's only if TSMC, who's making more money than anyone else in this space, hand over fist, is fielding the top clients like Apple, stays static. Like if they don't ramp up investment or experiments or improve their fab techniques, their foundry techniques too. It just seemed like such a weird thing to put out there. Like, don't worry about us not making any money this quarter, because in 5 years we'll beat TSMC. Ha ha! It's like, that's not how any of this works. So in 5 years, I bet TSMC is also going to be improving their techniques, and you might have Intel more aggressive in this game too. So, yeah. So Kappa Cash is saying, maybe Samsung can get some customers because TSMC can't make enough 3-nanometer chips for Apple. I'll be really curious to see, because I don't know that Samsung has really detailed roadmaps on 3-nanometer. Right now, it's like they're just getting their 4-nanometer C legs after failing miserably with the Qualcomm 8 Gen 1. So we'll have to see how that plays out. But, you know, TSMC's 4-nanometer process has been more desirable from other manufacturers. So, I mean, Samsung lost basically everybody this generation. And if TSMC can't keep up with the demand on 4-nanometer, I mean, maybe they start looking back at Samsung with these yields improving. What we would need is someone like Dr. Ian to come in and talk about, like, what is the difference between getting these yields up to higher levels versus the maturity of their process and how that contributes to things like power management. Like the difference between just, you know, printing out your chip versus actually incorporating that into a consumer facing product that has to have a battery. And that still seems to be a step behind on Samsung's process versus TSMC. Sorry, I didn't mean to kind of dig into that as as directly, but I mean, if we don't have a competitive industry here, we need Samsung to be competitive, but it's also just been frustrating to say, like, it seems like they're at least a year behind. So, if not more. So I wanted to kind of lead that out. And one of the reasons why I wanted to focus on Samsung is because Samsung at present is sort of the main supplier of our Pixel parts. Samsung displays, Samsung fabricated SoCs, Samsung radios and modems. And often when we see people complain about the performance of a Pixel, the things that they're complaining about are actually the Samsung parts. So it's a tricky conversation. Google has gone all in on supporting Samsung in a way that all of their other partners seem to be getting ignored. If it's watches, Wear OS is supporting Samsung components far better than Qualcomm components. Who makes the better components for watches right now? I don't think it's Samsung. If it's radio suppliers, Pixels use Samsung radios. And then we have to talk about your power management isn't as good sometimes on a Pixel. Like TK went out on a trip, and I'm kind of spoiling part of one of his conversations, but he went out on a trip. He was trying to dual SIM his Pixel 7, and the battery life was not great, and the phone would routinely run warm in the pocket. You know, like that's something that was also very similar to some of how we were using phones with Samsung fabbed 8 Gen 1s. So we keep kind of having to dance around these issues. There was another story. Windows Central had a story talking about sort of the end of the Microsoft Surface Duo, and no one would go on record. So I have to acknowledge, like, there is not an official declaration from Microsoft employees, but sort of on background and not quoted, there were some mentions of Google not supporting Microsoft at all in the development of these new tablet-style technologies. Microsoft brought so much to the table in improving the interactions and the gestures and the multitasking of Android. The Duo was the perfect next step for making an easily split-screenable kind of interaction. Microsoft knows how to make a Surface. They know how to make tablets. And all of those like things that we kind of see on Android 13 now came from Microsoft and Samsung. But who got early access and direct support from Google, and who didn't? So everyone was complaining about how long the operating system updates were taking for the Duo. But Microsoft didn't get any early access. Look at all the people complaining about Wear OS 3 on Fossil and Mobvoi. TicWatch. You know, like the TicWatch community, what little community there is like totally done, up in arms, this is the worst ever. But Google poured all of their support into Samsung. And when Fossil switched over to Wear OS 3, it was not a great experience. It took a lot of beta testing to get Wear OS 3 on a Fossil kind of up to snuff. And so I want to preface all of this. As we're looking at Google I.O., I'm very excited about what the Google hardware division is looking to put out. But I am very concerned about the Android ecosystem being put into this vice grip where, obviously, Pixels get stuff first. A Google Pixel running Google Android gets Google attention first and foremost. Okay, I get that. But then they've chosen Samsung as their sort of next in line. Because we don't want to upset Samsung. They don't sell very many Galaxy S phones, but they sell tons of Galaxy A phones. So let's not upset them. And then it's like to the detriment of everybody else. So Samsung gets preferential treatment and early access to a lot of this new stuff before everyone. And then that sets up a consumer frustration. Now you have a whole bunch of techies going out there saying things like, well, I mean, Samsung puts out the better software updates, and how come it takes Sony so long to put out an operating system update? Because Sony doesn't get preferential treatment and early access like Samsung does. How come Fossil can't make a perfect Wear OS 3 watch immediately out of the gate? I mean, Samsung has had Wear OS 3 for a whole year now. Keep going. Follow the thread on that, because there's a reason. There's a reason why. And if you're a nerd like I am and we care more about competition than only being a fan of one brand, this should be very concerning in how our landscape is eventually going to shrink and erode. I want more choices for consumers to get perfect fit gadgets for their needs. I don't like this idea of like Google picking a winner for us. And that winner being Samsung, that's not good for competition. We can see what that does to the North American smartphone market. Basically, it's just going to push more people over into getting iPhones. It's not great. But it's not even just like a free market kind of argument. It's a rigged market. All of the players at the top here have kind of bought their way into positions. Samsung's track record of IP theft and corporate collusion and bribing government officials should not be the company we look to. So it's like the beacon of premium tier Android. That's bad. So again, I'm going to get all pissy and say, well, regulatory action. But yeah, kind of. We should sort of look at stuff like that. Whew. Jonathan, we're absolutely angstrom measurement, maybe next for chip fab measurement. I mean, we're getting down into ridiculously, we're talking 3 nanometers. At some point, we've got to use a different measurement for chip fabrication. It's crazy. Let me get this out of the way here. So, Google I.O., when it comes to hashtag Team Pixel, and again, I would like to point out that my Pixel 7 came courtesy of Team Pixel. This is hashtag gift from Google. I've really enjoyed my time with the Pixel 7 Pro, and it really has been a very good example of a phone that does phone things, and I believe Pixels from the Pixel 6a, the Pixel 7, and Pixel 7 Pro represent the absolute best version of a streamlined point-and-shoot camera experience. I better than the iPhone, better than any other manufacturer, especially for those folks who want the most streamlined interaction and the least amount of fuss for getting a juicy HDR vibrant image onto social media. It really doesn't get better than a Pixel. And in many ways, it really doesn't get better than like a Pixel 6a for how we train software on using this hardware. But we've been seeing a number of articles coming out. Google themselves sort of showed off the new Pixel Fold. I'd like to hear in the chat, I'd like to see how many people think The Verge is going to be very happy with the Pixel Fold's design. Because if we remember, The Verge was really critical of the OnePlus Pad having bezels that were too small. So the OnePlus Pad has bezels that are smaller than an iPad 10th gen, right? Kind of a comparable Android versus iPad OS tablet comparison. Bezels are too small. I mean, you can't even use the Pixel Pad, right? That's a major con in their look at the OnePlus Pad, is that the bezels are too small. And so we finally got to see the Pixel Fold, and the Pixel Fold has larger bezels. So we're all going to be real happy, right? We're all going to be real happy. The Verge is going to be so happy to see practical bezels again, right? We're not going to see any criticism of the Pixel Fold design coming by way of The Verge. I mean, we can all agree on that, right? This is the sort of track record. This is what we're going to see, the consistency of the criticism. They're going to be very consistent in their criticisms, I'm positive. The Verge would never steer us wrong like that. So, this is a great question. Hassam, jumping right in. We're talking Google I.O. and Pixels, and I've got the Engadget article up. So I'll throw the Engadget article just for a prettier image than my face here on the mainstream. Hassam says, Juan, do you see a place for the 7A if its price is very close to the 7, especially that it can be found on sale now? So, yes. But Hassam, that's absolutely the concern that we're always talking about when we're looking at how a brand evolves. And this is something techies are really bad about, myself included. We approach all of these conversations from the entertainment of the device itself. The people who buy Pixel A series phones aren't entertained by the device. So that's a very critical part of the psychology that we're looking at here. When we look at how a company has to start, we can look at like a OnePlus model, we can look at the Nexus, the Google Nexus series of phones into the Pixel series of phones. And the people who are loudest about commenting on devices are absolutely miserable at only focusing on one or two specs, and then the lowest possible pricing for those specs. And that is always the death of an enthusiast conversation. You launch a Nothing phone, you launch a OnePlus, you launch a Poco type device, you launch a Pixel. It seems like the only way you can get any kind of traction in that conversation now is to launch a comparable product to a Samsung or an iPhone, but then undercut them significantly on price. And the label, it's like you're buying a fancy purse. The label isn't worth charging more. It's not worth it to spend more on a OnePlus Pro, except that you missed some incredible phones that could stomp on Galaxy S series devices at similar prices. But the label wasn't. If I flash my fancy purse and people don't know that it's a more worth it purse, then people won't know that I spent the money on it. And that's a major aspect of this kind of consumer psychology that we've trained techies on. So Google comes out and says, hey, we're going to do this phone. Well, it's only going to be worth it if you can charge the least. And unfortunately, that's not how all of this works. If the division can't show growth and you can't keep sort of building on like what new technologies cost, then we see the death of this kind of competition. So I think we could all agree that with a Pixel 7, Google was very aggressive at undercutting the price of competing phones with similar parts. That's pretty clear. I think it's pretty clear that a Pixel A series, so a Pixel 6A retail is $449. That seems like a reasonable price for that phone. It is regularly on sale for like $300, right? If you don't buy immediately at launch, then you get a much cheaper phone. But something tells me there was a window of profitability built into the Pixel 6a at $449. And that whenever it's on sale for less, they're hoping for you signing up on a service. Or like if you sign up on Google Fi, you can get a great deal on a Pixel 6a. This podcast not brought to you by Google Fi. So they're not selling the Pixel 6a at margin or at cost to make money. They're selling it like that to help you, to hope that you'll stay on Google Fi, and that's where Google Fi will bring back money from you owning a Pixel 6a. So you've got to play games with where you cut costs in one place and build costs in another. So you start the MSRP on the Pixel 7 higher. If we get wireless charging and a larger main camera sensor and a higher refresh rate display, like if we get a 90 hertz refresh rate display, if we get all these things that improve the Pixel A experience, bumping up the price $50 doesn't seem like that big of a deal. Then we have to see, will Google keep the Pixel 7 around? And that's a fair fight. You could look at the last days of the Pixel 7 on sales versus the brand new Pixel 7a at a higher price, at that launch price. And that's a difficult choice. It's really going to come down to some very granular differences between those two phones. They're looking very similar. But then what we should expect is a similar nudge going to the Pixel 7, a similar nudge up in price going to the Pixel 8 and the Pixel 8 Pro. I'm expecting that Google is now going to start slowly turning up the heat so that the only argument isn't we sell our phones at cost. If Google can't build on that and they can't charge more reasonably for what their phones cost to manufacture, then Pixels are a failed experiment. But you've got to start this out with appeasing the techies that can only talk about what's worth it for the price at the lowest common denominator, the most illiterate interpretation of an average consumer. So Google shocked everybody when the Pixel 6 came out as inexpensive as it did, and then the Pixel 7 stayed very, you know, low cost for high offerings. And I would expect the Pixel 8 is going to start nudging that price up. And we're going to hear techies gnash their teeth. How can Google expect people to pay more? And you're like, where was all that outrage on iPhones and Galaxies? of course, it's not there on iPhones and Galaxies. We're too busy complaining about the bezel size on the OnePlus pad. We've always got to make the Pixels and the OnePluses and the Sonys and the Motos lesser than so that we can get more clicks from Samsung and Apple fans. Yeah, Bray Gray, The Verge is going to cap on anything not made by Apple. It's not even that. I feel like they've always kind of held, or not always, but recently, more recently, have held to this idea that there's a winner and everything is lesser than the winner. And a few times that winner has been a Galaxy, but the winner is never going to be a product that pulls less SEO. So it always reinforces an echo chamber of only the top companies that spend the most on ads and marketing can ever be the winner. And now Google might have a chance because Google is spending more on advertising. Like, they're all over the NBA. That is not cheap. We might see in the next year or two where The Verge might pick a Pixel as the winner. But it's not through any merit of the device. And this is also why a winner-loser strategy in your reviews is inherently toxic. Because that means consumers are not getting the right fit for their needs. It means consumers are being led to buy whatever is most popular. And that's not always the right fit. Simon says, Hypno, $50 difference twixt a 7 and a 7A. And it'll probably drop. At some point, very soon, I mean, like, I will be very surprised if the Pixel 7 doesn't go on sale for less than the 7A. And then we have to have a fair conversation on what are the camera technology differences. The main camera sensor on a Pixel 7 is a beast sensor to have at that price. But then also you're going to be a year out on software. So does a year of extra software support make up a $50 or $80 price difference if you can get a Pixel 7 on sale? And I think that's a fun fight. I think very, very reasonably, there are people out there that can make that choice and look at those as pros and cons. Do I want the technically better Pixel 7 if it has a better camera sensor? Or do I want an extra year of software support from Google for somewhere in that kind of premium mid-ranger price? And this is all, of course, like, whatever all of the other brands are going to be looking at, if there's like a good mid-spec Moto, the Galaxy A looks stronger this year than it looked last year. So a Galaxy A50 might be a good competitive point for this. And then also, oh yeah, we're going to be getting more word on like international devices like Pocos and Redmi's and Realme's. So whatever Google does at $499, I guarantee you there will be some Xiaomi or BBK brand that offers you much better hardware, but only like a year of software support. And that hardware versus software debate is going to get brutal as we start looking at overseas phones. Is really the only company that can't compete in this space. Anything under $600 or maybe even $700, Apple has no answer for a really good, current, well-specced phone under $700. McCorkorin 3, it's a $100 price difference at MSRP, but there's also a significant size difference, which I think is important. Yeah, it's tricky. It's tricky to balance all that stuff out. Because the size difference is there, but it's not like the Pixel 6a is a small phone. It's just a smaller phone than like my Pixel 7 Pro. And then Daniel says, question, thinking of switching from a Zenfone 7 because of a bad flip motor, well, that's a bummer, and size to either Pixel 7 Green or the Moto Edge 30 Plus. I like the feel, more customization in the fingerprint scanner. So those are two radically different devices. If you're looking at a Pixel versus a Moto, the big argument is, what do you think you'll use more? Are you looking more at the streamlined point-and-shoot photography capabilities and the really good video capabilities of a Pixel? Or if you're looking at a Moto, you're really looking more at like productivity and laptop replacement. And those are like the killer features for both of those platforms. I have my Pixel 7 Pro. And as you can see, I keep holding it up here. I've got my Pixel 7 Pro in this really fancy case that has a magnetic grip attachment that can easily pop it onto Peak Design tripods. And actually, I have a Ulanzi plate on this also, so I can very rapidly switch between my nice travel tripods. There's a reason why the Pixel lives in this kind of photography and video setup versus my Moto Edge Plus. So this is the 2022 Moto Edge Plus. And when I travel, I've got a stylus-enabled phone that plugs into a laptop dock, and I don't travel with a real laptop computer. So I would not recommend these two devices to the same consumer in earnest. It's not like, hey, I need a new phone and I want it to be powerful. You got to give me more than that. So again, I'd lean more towards Moto for productivity, but I'd lean more towards Pixel for the ease of use of content creation, especially for social media focused content creation. Beyond that, I can't really answer that question. But again, I want us all to be thinking like that. There are different phones for different reasons. It doesn't make any sense to like, well, Samsung's the best. iPhones are the most popular. It kills me. It's like, I guess we can only recommend gaming laptops to everybody because they're the most powerful. Gaming laptops have the best performance per dollar. So when your grandmother needs a new laptop, make sure you only get her a gaming laptop because those are the best. Like, we would never do that. Toyota Corolla is still one of the most popular cars. So if you need a new car, why don't you just get a Toyota Corolla? Oh, but I need like something that can haul, like do heavy work. No, more Toyota Corollas are sold. So that's really the best way to car. Average drivers, most average drivers only need a Toyota Corolla. So you should just buy that. The bezels on a Toyota Corolla are acceptably large enough for you to drive a Toyota Corolla. I can't let that go. I refuse to let that go.
Hey, podcast listeners, I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Megapickle coffee mug of your very own. Savory, delicious Megapickles. Head on over to SomeGadgetGuy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch.
I just think it's hilarious that we would absolutely laugh a car reviewer out of the room if they were like, I took this Lamborghini, but most average drivers have to commute and drive through school zones. So I only drove it through this neighborhood with speed bumps at 15 miles an hour, and it's not worth it for the money. You shouldn't buy a Lamborghini because it's not worth it. When you drive a Lamborghini like a Toyota Corolla, it's not good enough, and you should just own a Toyota Corolla. I love it. I love it. Jack's Ghost, there is no best, just get what you like. And I feel like that's important. I would also add, get what you need, but you've got to really critically look at what you use. Because a lot of people end up way overbuying because they're worried about what they really need and what they really use. And if you just take a minute, so many people, I mean, especially even techies in this chat, in these chats, you're looking at like a $400 phone has a radical amount of compute power these days. are you really using apps and services to a degree that a $400 phone really can't keep up? And I feel a lot of us, if we looked at what our daily use was like, would probably kind of not always come to the conclusion that we needed to shop at the upper high tier, $1,000, the premium and ultra tiered devices. We're way off topic here, and I kind of want to wrap sort of the last, we get into these last 20 minutes and have some like Q&A and some conversations and stuff. Sorry, Google I/O, we're expecting to see Pixel 7a. I'm hoping we'll get some word on the Pixel 8 and the 8 Pro. What are some people's guesses for what might be in a Pixel 8 Pro? My guess is a new main camera sensor and a Tensor G3. I'll be curious to see if Google makes their lineup more complicated. One of the rumors that I've seen on the Pixel 8 Pro is different RAM capacities, that an 8 Pro base model will have 8 gigabytes of RAM and an 8 Pro higher storage tier will have 12. I'll be very surprised if Google divides their lines like that on the 8 and the 8 Pro. But yeah, I'm hoping we'll see the Samsung GN2 as the main camera sensor. We'll have a camera sensor bump where the Pixel 8 will compete with, like, I think the only other phone that really mass produced with that sensor was the Xiaomi Mi 11 Ultra. I would greatly prefer that over any of these really dumb 200 megapixel camera experiments. Go to the larger sensor size. Don't give me more resolution with smaller subpixels on the same size sensor. The current sensor size is awesome. What you can get in a Pixel 7 on that main camera sensor is fantastic. That is an excellent camera. So if we're going to spruce it up, or if we're going to make an argument for why a Pixel 8 should cost more, I want to see the larger sensor surface area, not higher resolution. So Farhan, yeah, that's exactly it. I remember this rumor about the Pixel 8 using a 1 over 1.2 inch sensor. That would be another Samsung sensor, and it was the sensor, if it is, that would be the sensor that was used on the Mi 11 Ultra. And that was a fantastic photography phone. Wasn't my favorite for video, but it was really good for stills photography, and it gets us really close to the one-inch camera sensor phones on Xiaomi and Vivo, which these have just been rocking my socks. One-inch camera sensors are the real deal. Let me see. Farhan, heck, a Snapdragon 4 Gen 1 is still more than enough for average consumers. I need to get my hands on a 4 Gen 1 because, I mean, I've played with the 8 and the 8 Plus, you know, like all of those. I haven't spent as much time on the sort of the mid-range and the entry level. And if the updates to the 4 Gen 1 are as significant as other people have said they are, not beyond Geekbench scores don't tell you anything. But if they really do perform like what people are claiming they can, a 4 Gen 1 would be plenty fine as a communications device daily driver and still be overkill for most people's needs. Cedric Owens is saying, I would be surprised to not see another feature removed from what we love about these devices. Well, Cedric, what's left? We've lost the headphone jack. We never had memory card storage on any Google devices except one. Was the first HTC Nexus the one that had a memory card slot? I think that might have been the only Google phone that really did. Someone please correct me in the comments here. But I'm not sure what else we can lose. NFC is still kind of too prevalent for too many other accessories and interactions. We have high refresh. That, I mean, it makes the screen look more fluid. What else can we lose? I'm hoping we'll see things added, but I'm not sure there's much left that we can pair off. Like, Pixels already don't have video output support, so you can't plug a Pixel into another display. there's so much there that I think we won't get. The other thing is, what are people's thoughts on Pixel tablet? There was a leak that suggested the 11-inch tablet could start at 600 euro, which would probably just be directly translated to the United States at around $600. But if we're talking a Pixel tablet, 11-inch screen size, a Tensor G2, which should run better in a tablet than it does run in a phone, but it's not going to compete with a lot of the horsepower and torque of like a Dimensity 9000, which you would find in the OnePlus pad. If we see a Pixel tablet at 600 versus a OnePlus pad at 479, how do people feel about a companion computer, an in-betweener Slate device that can do some pretty heavy lifting? If you have not tried video editing on a modern tablet, you're kind of missing out. In fact, in many ways, it's nicer than always having to come back to a full desktop. And if you compare it to like a mid-spec laptop, like a comparable $600 price tag for like a Core i5 laptop, you can wipe the floor with you just completely nuke the Intel-powered laptop at around that price. My OnePlus pad comparison is not pretty. So I love my Surface Laptop Go 2. I think that is a beautifully built student-grade laptop, and you can find it on great sales. Like, you can find it for sub-$600 on sale. 8 gig, 128 gig of storage. It's not a powerhouse device, but it's the nicest construction I think I've ever seen on something that we would want to hand to, like, a mid-school or high-school student. And then you pick up a OnePlus pad, and you do something like render 4K video. And the fastest I can get 4K video to render on the Surface laptop is an order of magnitude slower than what you can do on that tablet. It's just not even close. And the kind of video editing you would want to do on a tiny little portable machine is not the in-depth, let me make a documentary or a feature film from this computer. It is the, let me slam some clips together and throw in some transitions and throw on some text and do some fun stuff so that I can upload it to TikTok. Boy, howdy, it is not close. The tablet just demolishes like a comparably priced Core i5. So let's see. TED Talks Tech says, GSM Arena says no. Oh, GSM Arena says no, Galaxy. Nexus S did have an SD slot. I don't think the Nexus S did. I used to have a Nexus S. That was the first Samsung one. I want to say it was the HTC Nexus, the very, very first one. I think that might have been it, but I can't remember. Farhan says, not going to lie, I'd love to see LumaFusion coming to Windows. And what I'm hoping is that eventually we can convince LumaFusion to either support something like the Amazon App Store. Because if you can buy it on Amazon, then you can install LumaFusion on any Windows 11 PC currently available. And I bet you running on like a Core i5, you would be close, but probably about a generation behind in terms of like SoC performance, emulating Android on like a Core i5. I think your performance would be pretty close if we could get LumaFusion to work in the Android subsystem for Windows 11. But the only other thing that might work is if we can convince them to do business in a way where they could sideload it. Because then you could sideload it on Windows 11 too. I don't believe we're going to see LumaFusion come out with a native version of their video editing software for Windows. But I don't think it would be too difficult to get LumaFusion running on a Windows PC. You just got to jump through a few hoops. So Ravs4989 is saying maybe the ultra wide camera is the next feature to be omitted. Do we think that Google is going to look at axing an ultra wide camera from these phones? They just started adopting macro photography. You could do macro close up shots on a Pixel 7 and a Pixel 7 Pro. Can you do it on a Pixel 7? I know you can do it on a Pixel 7 Pro. The only reason why I don't think so, Ravs, is because the iPhone has an ultra-wide camera. And it's really cynical of me to say that, but the fact that Apple did it, if they got rid of that feature, they know they'd have people complain, well, even my iPhone 13 has ultra-wide camera on it. And I think that's one of the things that any of these companies are scared to do. They won't cut something from a comparably priced iPhone. And I think we've run out of things to cut that aren't on iPhones. Like iPhones never had upgradable storage. iPhone Pros finally have high refresh rate displays. I feel like Android manufacturers are going to be too scared to make their phones less like iPhones. So we'll see. Dave Burns. At this point, I can't even tell anymore. Like, what do tech reviewers want? Dave, can someone please tell me? Because I don't know. They've moved the goalposts so many times. Dave says, tech reviewers will dogpile them if they go with Zoom over ultra-wide. Maybe? I don't know. I feel like you're probably right, but I think it's just at this point, anything that's a change on a Pixel and doesn't immediately cater to the preferences of an iOS or Samsung owner is just written off as bad. It doesn't work like a Samsung. Okay, I guess it's the only thing we can have now. Hassam, I am totally with you on this one. I don't even have a good photo. I'm going to crib the Engadget rundown here. Hassam says, I wish they'd tease a new Pixel Watch. A sequel to the Pixel Watch is one option. Google hasn't said how often it will refresh its first in-house smartwatch, but the current model has ample room for improvement. I love that quote from Engadget. I like the Pixel Watch, but I'm not in love with the Pixel Watch. And again, my big frustrations with the Pixel Watch come down to the implementation of old Samsung SoC, and the Samsung radio on it is just okay. So that combination means I have a watch that if I use it, I need to charge twice a day. If I'm going to do sleep tracking and a workout track and keep up with all of my notifications and alerts, that's a watch that I can't make it through a day with one charge, and often I'm having to top off if I want to do a sleep track and a workout later in the day. And that's not enough. My old Tick Watch does not have Wear OS 3, and I don't know that I could care. Because when I use it to sleep track and do workouts, and I really work this watch, it still lasts for over 2 days on a single charge. So I always have a good buffer window where I can kind of top it off or fully recharge it without giving up the extra features that I would want to use on the watch, like sleep tracking, all day heart rate monitoring, things like that. I never have to scale back. So I care way less that it doesn't have Wear OS 3. I just don't know that I care on a Mobvoi because I got it for that hardware of being able to keep up for more than 2 days. And it's, you know, it's an older watch. It's not like that watch battery is brand new. And I ran that watch hard while I was really using it. There's definitely room for improvement. But I think one of the things that would help is if we got maybe word, not of necessarily a different, like a totally new refresh, but I think you could also just generate some interesting conversations with a Pixel Watch Plus. So you've got like a Pixel Watch. It's really cute. It's really little. It's petite. It's great for a number of people that have smaller wrists. And then you could step up just to a larger sized watch. So maybe a slightly more bolder casing or design, and then include a larger battery. And that could alleviate a lot of some of the early issues that people had with the Pixel Watch. Awesome Possum saying, how about ultra-wide on the selfie cam only as the compromise? I don't know that they'll mess with the selfie camera either. I don't know. Barry says, I wouldn't miss the ultra wide. Give me a main sensor and great telephotos and I can step back if I need an ultra wide. I was originally the ultra wide guy, and that was because our telephoto sensors were really garbage. When LG decided on doing two camera sensors and they picked an ultra-wide, I was really excited about that. Now, there's an extra kind of benefit. If your main camera sensor doesn't crop zoom very well, you can get close-up photography using an ultra-wide. But again, I mean, like, I'm living out of ultra-tier phones where I have at least three camera sensors on the back of that phone, even a Pixel 7 Pro. So if I had to pick between the two, I'm very bad at nailing that down. I don't want to lose either. I don't know. I guess if you gave me a really large telephoto sensor, I probably am using telephotos more these days than my ultra-wides. But when I need my ultra-wide, boy howdy do I need that ultra-wide. I don't know. I'm stuck. I don't have an answer. I can't pick. Don't make me choose. I have four cameras on the back of the Xiaomi 13 Ultra. I use all four of them, and I don't want to lose any of them. So I'll just keep them all. I'll just stick with that. That will be my answer. Jack's Ghost, just give me HDR 10 Plus. The Pixel HDR is pretty good, but the way that it does HLG highlights, it always seems to be a full stop brighter than it really needs to be, which then if you put it on a non-HDR 10 compliant blah, blah, blah display, or you try to edit that footage into another project and your timelines mismatch just a little bit, it's so washed out and it's so blown out. And I am so bad at color grading HDR footage. I'm just not good at that. Marilyn is saying if she had to choose between ultra wide and zoom, she would go with the zoom. I think a lot of people now are kind of leaning that way now that the telephoto sensors have gotten better. Caesar Salad is saying, do I still play around with the LG V60? I do. I haven't fired it up. I haven't fired it up a lot since getting Android 13, but it's still regularly kind of picked up and held, and I love messing with the dual display. I just haven't earnestly, like, really used it because I've just been on so many other phone reviews. I've got some stuff on my desk here that I can't pick up right now because that would be bad. Hold on, let me get this down here. Steve Pogue, do Qualcomm chips help watches last longer than Samsung chips? So the current Qualcomm SoC that's like in Fossils and Tick watches is actually a pretty nice, the W4100? Is actually a pretty nice step up. It is a level of performance that the Samsung SoC does not match. It's a newer process of manufacturing. It is better power efficient. And then why I like MobVoi is because they've added other technologies that help you get even more battery life out of those improvements from Qualcomm. But that's also one of the things that's kind of bitten them in the rear. They just recently put out a sort of, it's not even a press release, but it's kind of like an official reply to the people that have been frustrated with their lack of updates. And they say like, hey, we use this custom coprocessor. This is what helps us get extra battery life and manage applications on the watch. And we need more time. They're going to be putting out a beta and a preview. But when you're also reading the tea leaves, it's pretty clear that Google is not supporting the two companies that kept Wear OS alive. Like Fossil and MobVoi are way behind on getting these updates out. And I feel like it's my unlearned opinion. I feel it's pretty clear that Google wanted Samsung to kick them components and they didn't want Samsung to be a direct competitor with their own watches. So to get Samsung on board, they had to give Samsung an enormous head start over the competition. And that to me is not a good way to do business. That is how you rig a market and eventually arrive at fewer choices for consumers to vote with their wallets. But so far from what I've seen, Qualcomm is putting out better hardware than Samsung, and the SoC in the Pixel Watch and the current Galaxy Watches is not as competitive for what Samsung, I mean, like it, they could be doing better. So that's kind of my guess on that. Pixel smart glasses, that could be kind of fun. Hossam, if we get a little bit more word, we saw it at the last year's, they had Marie Kondo, and they had the AR glasses on, and you could see, like, real-time translation and stuff like that. And if any of that was sort of learned from the Focals by North, you know I'm going to be nerding out all over that pretty hard. I want that simplified heads-up display version of augmented reality. I don't care if it's fully 3D graphics, interactive, you know, tracks your position and does cool, like, maps are painted out in the scene in front of you. I don't care about any of that. What I want is to get back to all of the things that are on my smartwatch just being projected up at eye level. I had that with the Focals by North. It was incredible, especially having those Focals into the beginnings of the pandemic, where I could wear the little control ring through a glove because we didn't know what was going on with the disease and we were all like gloved and wiping down our groceries and it was freaking stuff out. But I never had to touch my phone out in public because I could see everything up at eye level thanks to the Focals. I could very quickly do things like speech to text replies. So my wife would text me and I'm out at Costco and I'm masked up and I'm all bundled up and we're all terrified of this crazy disease, and those Focals were amazing. So if I could just get back to what I already had, I just want a smartwatch UI up at eye level. That's it. I just want that so bad. If Google can get us back to that, I would be so happy. It would be amazing if we could get that back. Jack's Ghost, does anyone think we'll get a 5G connection without so much battery drain? Unfortunately, it seems like the promises of 5G, not great. LFA Reviews, which camera do you want? Juan? Yes, I want them all. And Bionic Scoop, yeah, dude, I really like that Google has built in HDR video. I mean, again, like HDR video on a Vivo, I think, kicks you down to 1080p. So having 4K HDR10, that's pretty cool. But their current implementation of it is not what I was expecting. It is super blown out. It is really difficult footage for me to work with because I'm not great at color grading anyway. But I've seen some people who can get some fantastic results out of it. It's just it takes me so much longer to do that. Another drink of water, and then we'll start wrapping this up. Oh, TED Talks Tech. I know a lot of people feel this way. I wish the Pixel 7 had the same telephoto sensor of the Pixel 7 Pro. It's unfortunate Google does not have a smaller option for the 7 Pro because I love the size of the Pixel 7. The Pixel telephoto cameras, I think, are probably the best in North America. And it is kind of a bummer that they don't have that, but I understand what they're trying to do for that three-tier price strategy. So you've got the Pixel A, sort of a more mid-ranger option, the Pixel Number, which is kind of premium mid-range into more flagship killer territory. I guess it's entry-level flagship. That's kind of what they're aiming for and what the OnePlus 11 is aiming for. And then you've got their Pro, which is just sort of an on-the-rails premium-tier phone. But when you look at, like, what a Pixel can do with that telephoto, it's pretty remarkable. And again, you've got to go to a Xiaomi 13 Ultra to find a competitive option, and then you've got to go to an Oppo Find X6 Pro to honestly beat what the Pixel 7 can do, especially if you shoot people. If you're trying to just take pictures of the moon and you don't care about fake AI, go for it. Any phone can do that. Super moon zoom mode on a Vivo. I think there's also a super moon mode on a Xiaomi. Great. It's not real, but you've got a neat AI drawing of what the moon looks like. But if you're like indoors in a cozy lit living room and you're hanging out with friends and you want to get a great candid of someone across that room, you need the larger telephoto sensor. So it's Oppo, Xiaomi, or Pixel. You're not going to get it done with a Samsung. You're not going to get it done with an iPhone. Those photos look like garbage in dim indoor lighting. So it is kind of a bummer that we don't have an option there. But then the Pixel 7 would be a more expensive device. And I know Google is looking at that number Pixel, the Pixel 7 and the Pixel 8, as being their like lowest margin device. This is how we disrupt what's happening in this space. We're not really making any money on it. So you don't keep putting the fancier technologies in that phone. You save that for the Pro, where you can build in a little bit more of a profit pad. Okay, I think we're about caught up here. Oh, Golan. That's kind of interesting. I haven't had those issues. For some reason, my OnePlus 11 does not support LDAC like the OnePlus 10 Pro. My OnePlus 11 has hooked up with my LDAC earbuds, but I, you know, whenever you're dealing with different codecs, you do have to kind of be careful because, like, sometimes it's just a mismatch between the earbuds and the phone. It might not have anything to do with LDAC. It could just be like, oh, what was which ones? Not my JBLs. Was it? I think it was the Neuras. So these are the Neuras. And I think like El Jefe reviews, and I still very much agree with him. These are like some of the highest quality earbuds currently on the market today. If you're really looking at like an audiophile listening experience, these are very, very good. But I think I might have this wrong, and Jeff will correct me if I do have this wrong. I want to say you didn't have support for LDAC unless you installed the companion app. I might have these confused with another pair of earbuds, but a few of these where you need to tell the earbud to connect over LDAC, not just the phone. So that can also be an issue too, where those settings mismatch. It could be something like I paired over Bluetooth, but the fallback is AAC. If I want to use LDAC, I've got to tell the earbuds to do that, and I can only do that through that earbuds companion app. Might be the Neura, I can't remember, but I know on OnePlus, you also have to go into the OnePlus controls to enable LHDC. So things like that can sometimes be mismatched. The phone and the earbuds aren't talking together because the manufacturer wants you to use their proprietary software. Simon says Hypno. Google should just ditch the Pixel name and call their brand AI Crypto. And then they'll get all the positive search. Love it. Yeah, Rami. Man, and again, when we get more information from Sony, Rami says, hey, Juan, hopefully Sony's new dual-layer sensor lives up to its promises, almost doubles the light intake and better depth of field. I don't think the depth of field is going to change tremendously because that is an optical component of the sensor and lens. So that's all going to depend on their aperture. If their aperture is faster than f2 on the Xperia Pro I, then we will have a slightly softer, shallower depth of field. But their claims on the low light performance and the ability to soak up photons on that sensor seem pretty legit. And right now, Sony is just crushing the camera sensor game. Samsung makes very good camera sensors. ISO cells are very good sensors. I love the GN1. I think the GN2 could be really interesting on a Pixel. But every new sensor that Sony has put out has just been a monster slap in the face. The trio, the quartet of sensors, the main camera sensor on my Xiaomi here, the 989, that 1-inch type sensor with three matched 858s, this is an incredible combination. And the fact that they all kind of work together, they process similarly, the three companion sensors are the same. That is such a good tactic. So I'm really anxious to see what Sony can do if they're really going to use the Xperia as like a place to launch a new camera sensor technology. That's going to be tip of the spear. That is like the most bleeding edge part of that conversation. And Sony's game is untouchable right now. They're completely in the lead, and I love seeing it. Yeah, Steve Pogue, the OnePlus 11 has LHDC support. Golan is saying my headphones, the one more Sonoflow. So I have the Sonoflow, and I don't remember if you needed the One More companion app. I might have to look into that. Yeah, I can't remember. Oh, yeah, and Steve Pogue is saying LDAC is more common among Soundcore and One More products. I think that might be something to just kind of check out. Maybe see if in your One More companion app, if there is a setting to enable high-res playback. Because if you haven't told the headphones to do it through a companion app, it might not know to do that. So we'll see. So Google I.O. coming up in a couple days, and we'll get more word on Android 14. We'll see probably some more images on the Pixel Fold. Just as a spoiler, I hope to spend some time with a Pixel Fold, but I'm not the foldable guy. I'm the camera guy. I'm the audio guy. So I probably won't be running a ton of coverage on foldables. I mean, for the foreseeable future, I just don't feel like the compromises make sense for a daily driver pocketable premium computer yet. And that's my preference. And you know, where we talk about how a reviewer has bias, that's kind of my bias, is they seem neat, but I'd rather have video out through the USB-C and the ability to connect it to a larger display when I need to, rather than having sort of an awkward squarish screen when I want it. Doesn't do as much for me when it also costs so much more than a phone and a tablet together. Because let's say the Pixel tablet with a Tensor G2 is going to be around $600. And then a Pixel 6a is going to be around $500. I know for a fact that a Pixel Fold with a Tensor G2 is not going to be a $1,200 foldable. So you've got to at least put up where a Pixel Fold is $200 to $400 better than the combination of a Pixel phone and a Pixel tablet as separate compute platforms. And that's really difficult. That's a really tricky proposition to make for consumers. And this is coming from the nerd who has both the Duo and the Duo 2. So I have a dumb bias, but I really liked dual display over plastic folding screens. And I know I'm wrong. I know my opinion there was not the popular opinion. So let me take one last drink of water, and then we're going to close out this show. Yeah, I kind of overdid it. Even coming right down to 2 hours. We're going to close out this show at 2 hours, but I probably should have tried to end the show a little bit earlier. Google I.O. Kicking off in a couple days. We're going to get some news there. Right around Google I.O. is the Sony Xperia press conference. So that's going to be kicking off, and hopefully we'll get some more news on what to expect from this next Xperia. I'm really excited to see what Sony is like our savior brand for content creators in North America, because we're not getting Xiaomi's, we're not getting Vivo's, we're not getting Huawei's, we're not getting Honor's. The only other company doing something a little different is Sony. So I'm like real anxious there. I'm like fingers crossed, really, really hoping we'll see something cool there. Is there anything else going on this week? Someone else said that there's another phone launch. Is there like a Chinese brand that's also going up? Is like a Realme coming out? I haven't been keeping up with leaks and rumors at all, because the big news this week was going to be Google I.O. I think something else is going on too. So we'll get a whole bunch of stuff this week. It's going to get real busy leading right into the end of into the end of the school year for parents. But then, you know, it's kicking off this summer. I'm going to be playing catch up like crazy on devices. Yeah, okay, Barry Johnson, there is a Realme coming out as well. This week is going to get busy. So folks, stay tuned, because there's going to be a lot to talk about. There's going to be a lot going on. And some really fun conversations. I think TK and I will have a lot to dig into as we get to the best of our week on Thursday. So that should be really exciting. And then we've got a whole crew of people streaming throughout the week. We've got Gadget Goddess on Tuesday. We've got Easy Computer Solutions on Wednesday. We've got Mike and Ike sometimes. Sometimes Mike streams. It's not been very consistent, but Ike Talks Tech on Thursdays. We've got LaShawn on Fridays. We've got El Jefe Reviews and the Nomad Tech Project over the weekend. You could stream tech content every day of the week. And you're going to get some great content creators, some great opinions, and some great conversations. It's a lot of fun. So, folks, thank you so much for tuning in, for checking out the stream, and for participating. This was a great chat. I really appreciate it. Everybody, have a great week, because it's going to be a lot of fun this week. We're going to have a lot to talk about this week. But also, just that that consistent reminder, with everything that's going on in the world and all the craziness that's happening, take care of yourselves so that you can also continue to take care of others. Because I know people that watch shows like this, you're often that person in your family and friends. You're that person who is the good resource, who's there to help supply better information than just whatever's conveniently most popular. So keep being that person, because we like those people, and those people really help others save money and get the most out of their gear. So tech is too fun not to take seriously. All right, folks, I'll catch you back here next week for another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show with more news on everything that's going to be launching this week. Be safe, take care. I love y'all. I'll catch you back.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.